Chapter 36. Senator Jobsworth. Senatorial positions in the Council of Genres are generally pulled from the ranks of the individual book council members who officiate on all internal book matters. They are usually minor characters with a lot of time on their hands, so aside from a few notable exceptions, the Council of Genres is populated entirely by unimaginative D4s. They meddle, but they don't do it very well. It is one of the CFG's strengths. I impatiently drummed my fingers on the wall of the elevator as I rose to the 26th floor of the Great Library and the Council of Genres. I checked in my bag and found I still had 2 eraser heads, but wasn't sure if a show of force was the correct way to go about this. If what Bradshaw had said was true, and Evil Thursday was commanding a legion of Danvers, I might not even have a chance to plead my own case, let alone Pride and Prejudice's. I decided that the best course of action was simply to wing it, and was just wondering how I should approach even this strategy, when the elevator doors opened and I was confronted by myself, staring back at me from the corridor. The same jacket, the same hair, trousers, boots, everything except a black glove on her left hand, which covered the eraser head wound, I imagined. Bradshaw was right. Thursday 1 through 4 had divested herself of her own identity and taken mine, along with my standing, integrity and reputation, an awesome weapon for her to wield. Not only as the CFG's LBOCS and as a trusted member of jurisfiction, but everything. Jobsworth, in all his dreary ignorance, probably thought that this was me, having undergone a bizarre and, to him, entirely fortuitous change of mind about policy directives. We stared at each other for a moment, she with a sort of numbed look of disbelief, and I hoped, with the expression that a wife rightly reserves for someone who has slept with her husband. "Meddling fool," she said at last, waving a copy of Pride and Prejudice that she'd been reading. "I can only think this is your doing. You may have won the first round, but it's merely a postponement. We'll have the reality book show back on track after the first 3 chapters have run their course." "I'm going to erase you," I said in a quiet voice. "And what's more, enjoy it." She stared at me with a vague look of triumph. "Then I was wrong," she replied. "We are alike." I didn't have time to answer. She took to her heels and ran off down the corridor toward the debating chamber. I followed. If we were externally identical, then the first to plead her case to the CFG had a clear advantage. Thinking about it later, the pair of us running hell for leather down the corridors must have been quite a sight, but probably not that unusual, given the somewhat curious nature of fiction. Annoyingly, we were evenly matched in speed and stamina, and her 10-foot head start was still there when we arrived at the main debating chamber's door, 2 minutes and many startled CFG employees later. She had to slow down at the door, and as she did so, I made a flying tackle and grabbed her around the waist. Toppled by the momentum, the pair of us went sprawling headlong on the carpet, much to the astonishment of 3 heavily armed Danver clones who were just inside the door. The strange thing about fighting with yourself is that not only are you of equal weight, strength, and skill, but you both know all the same moves. After we had grappled and rolled around on the carpet for about 5 minutes and achieved nothing but a lot of grunting and strained muscles, my mind started to shift and think about other ways in which to win, something my opponent did at exactly the same moment. And we both switched tactics and went for each other's throats. The most this achieved was that Landon's birthday locket was torn off, something that drove me to a rage I never knew I had. I knocked her hand away, rolled on top of her, and punched her hard in the face. She went limp, and I climbed off, breathing hard, picked up my bag and locket, and turned to Jobsworth and the rest of the Security Council, who had come into the corridor to watch. "Arrest her," I panted, wiping a small amount of blood from my lip, "and bind her well." Jobsworth looked at me and the other Thursday, then beckoned to the Danver clones to do as I asked. She was still groggy, but seemed to regain enough consciousness to yell, "Wait, wait! She's not the real Thursday. I am!" Jobsworth, Barksdale, and Baxter all swiveled their heads to me, and even the Danver clones took notice. In the CFG, my veto counted for everything, and if there was any doubt at all over which was the correct Thursday, I had to quash it here and now. "Want me to prove it?" I said. "Here it is. The interactive book project stops now." Jobsworth's face fell.
"Stop it? But you were all for it not less than an hour ago."
"That wasn't me," I said, pointing an accusing finger at the disheveled and now defeated Thursday, who was at the moment being cuffed by the Danver clones. "It was the other Thursday, the one from the crappy-as-hell TN series, who has been trying, for reasons of her own personal vindictiveness, to screw up everything I've worked so hard to achieve."
"She's lying," said the other Thursday, who now had her arms secured behind her back, and still seemed unsteady from when I'd hit her. "She's the ersatz Thursday. I'm the real one."
"You want more proof?" I said.
"Okay. I'm also reinforcing my veto on the insane decision to invade the racy novel genre. Diplomacy is the key, and I want all juris fiction agents released from their books and returned to work."
"But that was your idea," muttered Jobsworth, who, poor fellow, was still confused. "You said there was a bad apple at juris fiction, and you needed to flush it out."
"Not me," I said. "Her. To keep me from returning. And if you need any more proof, here's the clincher. We're not going to have her reduced to text. She's going to spend the next 2 years contemplating her navel within the pages of the great Samuel Pepys fiasco. She's smart and resourceful, so we'll keep her in isolation in case she wants to try to be me again. And even if she attempts to escape, she'll be reduced to text." Jobsworth needed no further convincing.
"It shall be so," he said in a faintly pompous way, and the other Thursday was dragged off, still uselessly proclaiming her unbogusness. I took a deep breath and sat down at my desk. I could feel a bruise coming up on the side of my neck, and my knee hurt. I stretched my hand and rubbed it where I'd struck her.
"Well," said Baxter, "I can't say I'm glad you've decided against either invading racy novel or cancelling the reality book shows, but I'm a lot happier that you are the one making the wrong decisions, and not some poorly written wannabe. What the hell was she up to?"
"As you say, just a jumped-up generic who wanted to be real. Better put a textual sieve lockdown on the great Samuel Pepys fiasco, both in and out. I don't want to even entertain the possibility of someone rescuing her."
Jobsworth nodded to one of his aides to do as I asked, and also, very reluctantly, to put a halt to the interactivity project and the racy novel invasion plans.
"But look here," said Colonel Barksdale, who seemed to be somewhat miffed that he wasn't going to spearhead an invasion of racy novel. "We can't just ignore Speedy Muffler and those heathens."
"And we shan't," I replied. "After we have followed all possible diplomatic channels, then we'll have a look at other means of keeping them in check. And I rule out nothing." Barksdale stared at me, unconvinced.
"Trust me," I said. "I'm Thursday next. I know what I'm doing."
He seemed to find some solace in this. My name counted for a lot.
"Right," I said. "I'm bushed. I'm going to go home. We'll discuss things tomorrow, right?"
"Very well," replied Jobsworth stonily.
"We can talk at length then about the falling read rates and what you intend to do about them."
I didn't reply and left his office. But instead of going back to Swindon, I took a walk in the corridors of power at the CFG. Everything was busy as usual, the debating chamber in full swing, and there was little, if any, evidence that we were no longer at war or rewriting the classics. I stopped by the large picture window that faced out onto the other towers. I'd never really looked out of here for any length of time before,
But now, with time and the book world as my servant, I stared out, musing upon the new responsibilities that I had, and how I would exercise them first. I was still undecided 20 minutes later when Bradshaw tapped me lightly on the shoulder.
"Old girl?"
He startled me, and I looked around, took one glance at who was with him, and drew my automatic.
"Whoa, whoa," said Bradshaw hurriedly. "This is Thursday 5.
"How do you know?" I barked, pointing my gun directly at her, my sensibilities keenly alert to any sort of look-alike subterfuge. "How do we know it isn't the evil bad Thursday back here in disguise or something?" Bradshaw looked mildly shocked at my suggestion.
"Because she's not left my side since we last saw you, old girl."
"Are you sure?"
"Absolutely. Here, I'll prove it."
He turned to Thursday 5.
"What were the names of the Von Trapp children in The Sound of Music?"
Thursday 5 didn't pause for an instant, and recited in one breath. "Kurt, Friedrich, Louisa, Brigitte, Marta, Gretel, and Liesel."
"You see?"
"You're right," I said. "Only a total drip like Thursday 5 would know that." "Or at least," I added hurriedly, "that's what Evil Thursday would think." I clicked on the safety and lowered the gun. "I'm sorry," I said. "It's been a tough day, and my nerves are in shreds. I need to get home and have a long, hot bath, and then a martini." Thursday 5 thought for a moment. "After you've drunk the long, hot bath," she observed, "you'll never have room for the martini."
"Say what?"
"Never mind."
"We've just come to congratulate you," said Bradshaw, "on re-reversing the vetoes. Pride and Prejudice is running precisely as it should, and without the interactive book council idiots to set any new tasks, we're in the clear. The Bennets wanted me to send you their very best, and to tell you to drop around for tea sometime."
"How very proper of them," I said absently, feeling a bit hot and bothered, and wanting them to go away. "If there's nothing else..."
"Not really," replied Bradshaw. "But we wondered. Why did you lock her up in the great Samuel Pepys fiasco?"
I shrugged. "Punishment to fit the crime, I guess. Are you questioning my judgment?"
"Of course not, old girl," replied Bradshaw genially, exchanging a glance with Thursday 5.
"That explains why I can't get back in," murmured Thursday 5 in dismay. "Is this permanent? I know my book's unreadable, but it's home."
"Listen," I said, rubbing my scalp, "that's your problem. Since when were you part of the decision-making process?"
Bradshaw's mobile footnotophone rang.
"Excuse me," he said, and wandered off to answer it.
"It's been a long day," murmured Thursday 5, staring out of the window at the view. "You must be tired. Do you want me to fetch you a chai?"
"No, I don't drink any of that rubbish.
What were you saying about the hot bath and the martini again?" She didn't have time to answer.
"That was text Grand Central," said Bradshaw as he returned. "We've been getting some major narrative flexations inside the great Samuel Pepys fiasco. It seems the entire first chapter has broken away from the rest of the book."
"What?"
"As I said, it's a good thing no one reads it these days. We've tracked Thursday to page 208.
I took a deep breath and looked at Bradshaw and Thursday 5 in turn. "This is unfinished business," I said quietly. "I'm going to put an end to her once and for all." They didn't try to argue with me. I should have killed her there and then in the corridor. What was I thinking of?
"The book's been two-way sieved," said Bradshaw. "Call me when you're about to jump, and I'll get text Grand Central to open your portal. As soon as you're in, we'll close it down, and you'll both be trapped. Do you have your mobile footnotophone?"
I nodded.
"Then call me when you're done. Use Mrs. Bradshaw's middle name, so I know it's you, and really you. Good luck."
I thanked them, and they walked off down the corridor before evaporating from view. I tried to calm my nerves, and told myself that facing Thursday couldn't be that bad. But the consequences if I failed were high indeed. I took another deep breath, wiped my sweaty palms on my trousers, made the call to Bradshaw, and jumped all the way to page 208 of the Great Samuel Pepys Fiasco.